But I testified for Congress about boxing a couple times in the 90s. And all of the problems I identified are still here in 2022. My brother died in the early 90s when I was at HBO. Suicide, and that's one of the reasons why I sort of consider myself a mental health advocate. But I, in order not to get myself drinking or drugging myself into oblivion after his death, I threw myself totally into work. And we're sitting there having lunch, and he had this like strange, aggressive, perturbed look on his face. And I was just trying to make chit-chat. So we're talking, and I'm chatting with Cedric. I'm chatting with some of Cedric's employees are there. I'm at the table. And I look at Ike, and I said, "So, Ike, where are you living these days?" And he looks at me, and his eyes get really wide. And he grabs a steak knife, and he puts it over his head, and he plunges it into the center of the table so that the knife is embedded 2 inches.
Hello, and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tristix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
You couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beating me. He said, "Well, let's bully him back."
In the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
There's winning, and there's nothing else.
Hello and welcome back to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tris Dixon. And this week I'm joined by another Hall of Famer, Lou DiBella. Lou, like last week's guest, Kathy Duva, was inducted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame last weekend, and I was there with them both. Firstly, it was wonderful to meet Kathy out there, having recorded the podcast with her last week. After our podcast, actually, she was told by plenty of people out there how much they enjoyed the podcast, which I did too. When Boxing Life Stories is all said and done, that will be one of the classic episodes. I thought Kathy was tremendous. If you haven't listened to it, go back and check it out. Also tremendous was promoter Lou DiBella. Lou and I have talked quite a bit on the phone since Damage came out, as he is the one authority figure in boxing's public eye who has really fed back to me his thoughts and feelings about the book in a very positive light. Fighters like Carl Frampton and Tony Jeffries have been great also. And so have physicians like new Hall of Famer Dr. Margaret Goodman and journalists like Thomas Hauser and Thomas Gervasi and Matt Christie, I'll add into that. But Lou has been thinking about the content since before the book came out, and it clearly struck a chord with him. I'm grateful to know Lou, and I was really grateful last week that during his induction week and the day before he promoted the big showbox card at the Turning Stone, he took an hour and a half out of his crazy schedule. And it is crazy out at the Hall of Fame. You're sort of here, there and everywhere to talk with me for this podcast. I've been wanting to do this with Lou for ages. So for him to do it on one of the busiest weeks, probably of his life, really, when you're there with family, friends, colleagues, and you're promoting a show as well, I was truly appreciative. In this pod, we talk about his careers for HBO and as the captain of his own promotional ship. His love of rescue animals and his relationship with some of the big names in and out of the ring. I'm not one for swearing, but Lou gives a shit about the sport, basically, and the fighters. And you'd be amazed at how many people don't have that level of gratitude towards them. Talking of gratitude, huge thanks to my sponsors, as always. The guys that support me through thick and thin. Delco Safety Compliance, they're a leading provider of professional fire risk assessment and safety services nationwide, and they provide expert impartial advice on all aspects of fire health and safety compliance, and you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. We're also brought to you by Hanson Lee Resourcing, and they were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, they'll help you retain them, and you can find out more at Hanson Lee. Before I get to Lou, I just wanted to mention a couple of things. If you can spread the word about this podcast, it would be terrific. It was nice to bump into so many people in America who tune in every week, by all accounts, and that was fantastic. And if you can leave a review wherever you choose to listen to Boxing Life Stories, it's hugely appreciated. It really helps with the algorithms online and all that kind of stuff. Which, if you like supporting Boxing Life Stories, then it's a huge help. Talking of supporting Boxing Life Stories, it's also a huge help that I have some people on my Patreon. You visit patreon.com/TrisDixon and you can support this podcast as an independent content creator for as little as £5 a month. Up there already are interviews with Baby Joe Messi, referee Tony Weeks, and trainer Aaron Snowell, who was famously in the corner the night Mike Tyson fought Buster Douglas, who's also actually in the corner the night Frankie Randall upset Julio Cesar Chavez. So there's around 4 hours of content up there, as well as the latest on my book about Matthew Saad Mohamed. Back to Lou, just before we met, Lou had been on the phone with Jermaine Taylor, and Lou was thrilled to hear that the once troubled Taylor is in a good place and really sorting himself out. And that's where we pick up this conversation.
But anyway, Jermaine, I called Jermaine about a couple of months ago. His wife called me, said he's doing much better. I called him, and I guess it sounded, I'd never had a conversation with someone that went to the 12-step program.
Yes.
But it was one of those, but it was almost that kind of conversation. I said to him, I said, I heard you doing, your ex told me you're doing better. And I just want to give you a call. It's been a long time. I hope you wanted you to know I have nothing but love for you, even though we haven't talked to each other. He said, Lou, I got nothing but love for you. You gave me great advice. You were great to me my whole career. He said, the only person who let me down was me. He said, it wasn't you. I don't know why I ever let Pat Burns, who was my trainer. He did everything right by me. He said, all the problems I had in my career were me. And everything I did was to myself. And he said, upsets me sometimes when I look at some of the criticism you get about me, because you didn't do anything but all the right things for me. And it was a very nice conversation.
We're obviously...
I called him today. I spoke to him today to tell him that I was going to mention him in my Hall of Fame speech, and I will.
And people are interested to hear that how Jermaine's doing, because obviously the last thing people heard was that he was right off the rails.
He was, but he needed to hit the bottom to get off the bottom.
So is he still out in
he's out there, but he's seeing his kids. He has a relationship with his kids. His wife, his ex-wife, and and her new husband just said positive things about where he is in his life. That Jermaine really is in a good place again.
Does he want anything to do with boxing?
No, not really. I told him I wanted to bring him to a fight to come with me. I told him it'd be a good idea if people saw him okay. I think it'd be cool. I don't know that he wants to go and have to tell his story. It's one thing to tell the people you care about what you need to tell them. It's another thing to reappear in the sport and, what do you say?
Yeah, of course.
But I was very happy to talk to him, and I was very happy. Like, today he sounded like the old Jermaine I knew. So it was nice to talk to him.
So you obviously get inducted into the Hall of Fame this year. Does this period of time, and since it was announced, do you reflect back a lot over the
more
journey?
More than I ever have. But I think it's a combination of factors. A lot of things happen at once. I found out about the Hall of Fame December of 19, right before the pandemic. And then I lost my dog a week later, and then we were in the midst of the pandemic. And the combination of losing friends in the pandemic and getting into the Hall of Fame and having that, my whole business closed down and my baseball business closed down for that period of time, it was the kind of time that caused you to do some thinking. And then during that time, I lost a lot of close friends. One of the major ones being Jimmy Glenn, who was like my uncle, like a close family member to me.
Was an iconic boxing guy who I think should be debated about for the Hall of Fame on his own right, given the legacy he's left in Manhattan.
I agree with that, yeah. For a lot of reasons, what he did as a trainer, what he did as a gym owner. And then, the Jimmy's Corner, that bar is a cathedral of boxing. It's with a liquor license.
So when you did look back then?
Yeah, yes. It caused me to do a lot of reflection. If there was one thing I took out of it, is as much as I've had a love-hate with my boxing career and with the sport, look, my life is better because I embraced boxing and I met people and went places and did things I never would have gone. Gone to 50 countries, had lunch with Nelson Mandela, had Mandela calling me to talk boxing in the 90s. I met presidents and kings and writers and the most amazing people on earth, you know, the most creative people, poets and writers and actors and musicians. And I hung out with, I know so many iconic people who love boxing. And it makes you ask yourself why, but the answer is self-evident. Like, if you're a decent person, you're going to see the darkness in boxing. But if you're a decent person, you're going to see the darkness in politics. You're going to see the darkness in the world, you know? And boxing, Ed Brophy said this today in his brief comments about how boxing is a microcosm in a lot of ways of the real world, more so than any other sport. It's sport in its most basic form, man against man, woman against woman, not always the best athlete, not always the better, more skilled person winning. It's filled with intangibles, heart, guts, balls, if you want to call it, the ability to sustain punishment and pain, the ability to inflict it.
So when you reflected, were you up? You were up. You know, if you were at the tables here in the Turning Stone, you're up in terms of what you've put into the sport.
Yeah, I'm up.
Do you feel by a long way?
Up enough that I have no regrets.
But you carry a burden with you, don't you, about is it a guilt in being involved with boxing? Because we've spoken a couple of times on the phone, and I know sometimes...
Well, everybody who knows me comments on the fact that I've been saying the same critical things for as long as they know me. And also that I've been, you know, threatening to leave from shortly after I left HBO to start my promotional company. I've been sort of always threatening my endgame. There are things about the sport that are very difficult for me right now, and have been for years. But there are also things about the sport that are as beautiful and as poignant as they always were. You know, there's a lot of sinners in boxing. There's a lot of corruption. There's a lot of unnecessary... health and safety is not adequately protected. You and I know that. We talk about it. We've had that conversation many, many times. It's difficult for me at this point in my career, where I've been in the business for 33 years, and I am actually watching fighters where I was intimately involved in their careers, either as a network executive or as a promoter. I'm watching a lot of fighters pay the price for their bravery, pay the price for their warrior status. When I sit down and talk to them now, when I see damage, you know, it's why the title of your book was so perfect for me, you know. I think I told you the story. I haven't told a lot of people the story, but I went to a fundraiser for Iran Barkley last summer. Mike Tyson was there. Tim Witherspoon was there. I mean, there were 100 ex-fighters with name recognition there supporting Iran, and it was a sort of a fundraiser for fighters that have suffered damage. It was one of the more... I saw a lot of old friends, and I enjoyed that, and I hugged a bunch of people. It was one of the first things I went to after COVID. And I found myself in my car, like, shaken up by my conversations with so many people in that room, and every one of them was damaged.
Everyone?
Everyone. I mean, no exceptions among the ex-fighters. Not one exception. And...
When I go to things like that, I feel guilt. When I get in the car afterwards, I think... I'm in the same business, and I'm in this car, touch wood, unscathed.
Yeah, I feel there's a degree of I don't know.
I get a bit of imposter syndrome, you know, because I haven't paid the dues that they've paid.
I don't have that feeling, that part of it. There's a degree of guilt. I think of Patrick Day and Levander Johnson every day, literally. Yeah. I mean, literally, one of them. Or I think about them a lot. Yeah. They paid the ultimate, you know, sacrifice. They died following fights. That being said, we know it's an inherently dangerous sport. I also know that it saves a lot of lives.
Sure.
And that happens to be true. We're not a sport of the affluent. You know, we're not a sport of rich kids. We're a sport of poor kids. We're a sport of immigrants. We're a sport of people fighting their way out of something, whether it's a ghetto, or fighting their way out of prison,
or
fighting
sort of
their way out of trauma,
yeah.
Right, or something. People that have an easy route in life generally don't box, you know? So I do appreciate that it is a way out for a lot of people. But it's also somewhat inexcusable that the problems, I mean, I testified in the 1990s as a young guy. You know, I started at HBO in my 20s, around 1990. And I had a nice rise there really quickly, but I was a young kid. In fact, that's one of the reasons why I think I had such a quality career at HBO was I wasn't much older than the fighters. I was signing the contracts.
Sure.
And we were almost contemporaries. So, you know, when I was hanging out with guys like back when Pernell Whitaker, Lennox Lewis, whatever, we were sort of contemporaries.
Into the same sort of things,
yeah,
and the same
yeah,
vibes.
Music and whatever, yeah. And I vibed with a lot of them, and it was a great experience. But I testified for Congress about boxing a couple times in the 90s. And all of the problems I identified are still here in 2022. And I think a lot of them could be fixed.
Well, that's frustrating, right? And that's, I was literally just going to say that. That's got to be the most frustrating thing, right? Because we know what some of the problems are, and they're not a hard fix. Maybe we're not the people to do it, but there are people in the sport that could do it.
Yeah, but we've created a system that's untenable. You know, four ratings organizations. Some of which have very good intentions, and a few of which do very good things among their portfolio, all of whom have made contributions that are negative. And one of them, in my view, is almost a criminal enterprise. So, you know, that system leads to fractured titles, leads to unfair ratings, leads to questionable judging. You know, at least the WBC makes an effort with testing for steroids and other banned substances, but there's completely inadequate administration of the sport of boxing. State and governmental regulation of boxing hasn't worked, and we don't self-regulate in any meaningful way.
Have you thought about taking that step and setting something up where you try to start an umbrella organization with you and some of the good guys in boxing, where you try to make the changes? Have you thought about doing
it's,
that?
It's not for the people that wanted. It really would need to be a groundswell around the industry that we need self-regulation. There'd have to be some kind of unanimity. Look, I don't plan on being a promoter forever. I have no desire to be Don and Bob. I'm not going to be doing this at 90. I don't have the energy for it.
How old are you now, Lou?
62. Which I can't believe I'm fucking 62.
How long have you got then?
I don't know.
In promoting.
I'm still signing people. I don't think I'll be out in the next year or two. But you know what? I am changing my orientation, though, a little bit. You know, I'm not looking. I have fewer fighters now in number than I did 2 years ago. And while I'm still signing people, I'm being very selective about who I sign. And I want to be less... it's foolish. I know myself too well to think I'm going to be able to walk away cold in the next couple of years. I won't. But I want to be less heavily invested in it. I also maybe want to create a situation where I set up the people that work for me in a way that my company exists beyond my full-time.
So what you
situation.
Sound like? You sound like an addict who's trying to wean himself off, right?
I think I am in many ways. Look, I mean, you know, I was doing some reflection today talking to Ed Brophy. I remember 10 years old, 11 years old, the transistor radio under my pillow, listening. People don't even know what a transistor radio is. It's those small little radios you put a battery in. You got AM radio stations. And I remember having it under my pillow, listening to Round by Round updates when I was, like, it was past my bedtime and Ali was fighting Frazier at the Garden, and I'm getting Round by Round updates on my transistor radio under my pillow. And, you know, here and then to have grown to a point in the sport within 30 years thereafter that Ali and Joe became friends of mine and acquaintances of mine, and I knew Muhammad's family and Joe and his family and spent significant time with both of them, you know, to have been sitting as that kid with that radio under the pillow, and then your heroes become your friends, you know, and growing up even, you know, in the 80s, going to law school and college and watching, you know, Hagler, Hearns, Leonard, and Duran, and to have the four kings become my four buds, you know, I mean, dude, I had a, you know, there's nothing, I don't regret the ride. It's been a long, to quote my favorite band, The Grateful Dead, what a long, strange trip it's been, but I don't have regrets. You know, I'm really humbled by this weekend, and my real vibe in my own being this weekend is gratitude. Sure. I've met a lot of great people through boxing. I've met saints, but you know, and I met sinners. I've seen the darkness of boxing. I've seen its most glorious moments. I've had most uplifting experiences, and some that have had me in great need of personal reflection and such. But I sort of think that the world, the reason we're so compelling, the reason we're so theatrical, so poetic as a sport is the reality. In some ways, we're sport its most honest form.
Yeah.
It's self-evident. Our problems are self-evident. So are the glorious things about our sport and industry.
Sure.
They're all there to be seen. They're there to be suffered, and they're there to be celebrated. You know, and there's an honesty about that. One last thing. And we also, one of the most fundamental things about life is that none of us escapes unscathed. And none of us are going to be here forever. And in that course of getting to the end of our road, we're going to lose friends. We're going to lose people. We're going to get knocked on our ass. We're going to go broke. We're going to be bankrupt. We're going to make mistakes that we regret. We're going to celebrate moments of joy. But the road for everybody is one of ups and downs.
Sure.
And the basic what's boxing in its basic form? It's, you're going to get knocked down, or you're going to get up.
Yeah.
Like, that's the fundamental question. You're going to get beat up, or are you going to make it through it? And that's sort of like life, isn't it?
When you talk about that transistor radio, were your parents into boxing at all, or were you having to do that on the quiet?
My dad was into boxing a bit. My dad wasn't an immense sports fan, but he was into boxing a bit.
What did he do for work?
He worked for the government. He was in worked for United States Customs Service, and he was a supervisory import specialist and worked for the U.S. government. My mom was a teacher and a poet. My parents were big influences on me. My dad was like the Rock. My mom was and still is at 88 years old, brilliant and wacky and creative. My mom was the one who made me believe that I could do anything, and my dad's the one that grounded me.
When you said your dad was like the Rock, you don't mean the Rock as in the Hollywood superstar. You mean the Rock of the house.
Like a rock. My dad was one of the most solid people I ever knew.
Yeah.
And my dad also was the kind of guy, I remember, he used to take me to work when I was a kid. And I know that he enjoyed taking me to work. And one of the things I always enjoyed about going to work with him is that there were a lot of people that reported to my father. But it was clear that he had a great relationship with them. And it was always clear to me that they liked him and he liked them. And there was this mutual respect thing. And when I met, you know, two of the lessons I got from my dad that I think I've carried most into my life. One was, if you want to be respected, then you have to put out respect. You have to treat people with decency and respect. And particularly if you're in a situation where there's anyone subordinate to you in any way, that put yourself in their shoes, how would you want to be treated? And that's what's going to come back to you, is what's going to be what you put out there. You know, so if you want respect, you need to earn it. That was a message I got from my father. And the other message I got from my father, you know, it was clear to my dad, I mean, I went to Harvard Law School, I was always a good student, and I was making a lot of money very young as a lawyer. I took a huge pay cut to go to HBO. But I can't really say I struggled career-wise ever. Right? And my dad never had any worries that I wasn't going to have enough money to help my family or myself or whatever, or support myself. But the message that he really imparted to me was like, you can drive a Bentley and you can have a beautiful home on some suburban paradise, or a place on the ocean, and you can achieve great things and wear expensive watches and beautiful clothes. But if you're a piece of shit, you're a piece of shit. And if you're a piece of shit, none of that other stuff matters. And just basically that, sort of frankly, that was maybe the greatest lesson my dad tried to impart on me. And more so, actually, as I became more of a success as an adult.
Yeah.
He'd want me not to forget that message. And I hope to think I did him proud.
That's really important. Obviously, you know, now with your own promotional company, you obviously want that same vibe in your office in terms of you respecting your staff and vice versa. In terms of advice, my dad, the one telling bit of advice my dad ever gave me was, don't hang around with people that don't say please, thank you, or sorry.
Yeah, and that's great advice, but I got to tell you something, that significantly in this world limits who you're going to hang around with.
Yeah, it does. But it makes the world a nice place.
It makes the world a much better place. But I got to tell you, if I'm going to make a criticism of boxing in 2022 compared to boxing when I first got into it, it's less collegial, it's less civil,
yeah.
More of us hate each other than vibe with each other. The setup of exclusive networks and exclusive sides of the street, as people talk about in boxing, contributes to people not working together the same way. It's much harder to make the big fights. And you see a lot less loyalty. You see a lot less gratitude. A lot of those things that your dad said were, you know, hold above all else are some of the things that I sort of wish were more prevalent today.
Is there, as a promoter, do you have an air of distrust with you in the sport when someone approaches you to do something? Is your initial thing, what's the angle? What's their angle? What's in it for them?
Sometimes, and it depends who I'm dealing with. I've been accused, bizarrely, and people wouldn't believe this, but sometimes I've been accused of naivete, where I still want to take people at their word, at their best. You know, when you're in boxing long enough, you sort of learn how to read people. I think when you're in anything long enough, you learn how to read people.
I did this podcast with Kathy Duver just a week ago, and she said, like, nothing prepared her for life more than boxing because of who you have to deal with and how you have to deal with them.
I think law school help prepare me for boxing. I mean, you know, it's an industry full of conflict. And the one thing I took out of law school was a way of critical thinking to, you know, how might someone screw me and how might I prevent it?
Yeah.
And that's the law, that law degree, there's a reason there are so many lawyers bopping around boxing. Because it's a world full of conflict. But what Kathy said, I sort of agree with, because if you can, we are as litigious as any other industry. There's as much dishonesty as in any other industry. We are often counterproductive in how we conduct business. We make mistakes all over the place as an industry. You know, when you watch our biggest events, so many of our biggest events, the undercards are unwatchable.
Yeah.
And you'll sit there for 4 hours waiting to be entertained while you wait for a main event. And then people wonder, why are UFC shows on a regular basis more successful? Well, they're providing a more consistent product sometimes.
Sure.
You know, there are things I always feel like we can do better in our business, you know? I think that we have one great, great, great resource in boxing that is able to overcome most of our problems, and that's the fact that fighters, boxers, have mentalities different than any other athlete and are as compelling as any other athlete in any other sport. And I think the reason why, from people from Mandela to princes and kings and presidents and writers and musicians and, you know, most famous people on earth are among our large niche yeah. of fans. And it's because of that essence of the fighter.
Sure.
You know, the essence of the warrior, the you know, underdogs. Where do you find more underdogs than in boxing? And to some extent, being a sport of the underclass, we're a sport of underdogs across the board.
Sure.
You know, even our greatest athletes.
Sure.
But you know, I complained in 1993 or 1994 in one of the first interviews I ever gave about the sport, that the majority of our fighters live below the poverty line. And here we are in 2022, and the majority of our fighters live below the poverty line. You know?
In a sport where there is some big money flying around.
Yeah, but there is big money flowing around, but the big money is in that 1% of guys that are at the top. And frankly, the biggest money is in that concentration of probably the top 10 or 12 fighters in the world that are making the overwhelming majority of the money. But a quality fighter who is out there as a professional fighter, fighting 4 or 6 times a year as an opponent or a challenger, it's very hard for that fighter to survive.
You had mentioned the law stuff. Did you have big serious cases as a lawyer?
Well, when I was a lawyer, I was more a contract lawyer.
And, okay.
Now, interestingly, as a promoter, I've never said to myself, "I've ever been sued." I really have not been subject to. I've not been in a lot of lawsuits. There are a couple of times I sued other people. I've really never been sued. I might have been countersued.
You and Hopkins was the biggest thing you've had, right?
But I sued Bernard.
Yeah,
I sued Bernard, and Bernard and I are cool now. We're friends. I mean, we're fine. You know,
how bad was that period? Because it was
It was awful. I mean, he accused me of something terrible. It was a lie. I beat him in court. He paid me. We made peace privately after that.
Straight away.
What?
Straight away, directly after it, or did
we had
take
to pay
time?
Me? No, it took time for us to. I mean, there was tension for a long time. I mean, it was one of the worst things that ever happened to me, and I had a lot of hostility about it. And then, you know, it's hard for Bernard to ever admit that he's wrong. Bernard's an amazing athlete and an amazing story of overcoming, you know, obstacles and your own issues. But in the course of years, Bernard and I buried the hatchet, and I'm glad. It's always better if you can bury the hatchet to bury the hatchet. Negative energy is not a good thing, and the older I get, the more I realize that.
When you guys were together, you were on fire together, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I had a lot to do with the rise of Bernard. Those couple of years we were together, you know, HBO wasn't really... Bernard wasn't getting any favors from anybody. And then when I left HBO, I had dates that I could provide fights to HBO, and I used some of those for Bernard. And the deal that was made for Bernard to fight Tito Trinidad with Don King was made with me, and involved some of my dates that I was able to program for HBO. So the Bernard Hopkins Trinidad fight was promoted by King in association with me, and it gave Bernard that huge opportunity, which he took advantage of in spectacular fashion.
Have you ever topped that night? I mean, I was there in the garden that night. It was obviously in the wake of 9/11.
Well, you know, in some ways, the first fight between Germain and Hopkins, when Germain beat Hopkins, and everything was so personal with Bernard and I, that was like a moment of incredible personal satisfaction and victory for me. And I remember walking out of the ring and telling Bernard I was 2-0 against him, once in court and right there. And then Germain beat him again in a controversial fight. That was probably that Germain, the first Germain Taylor fight was a highlight of my career. The first Ward Gatti fight. But all three Ward Gatti fights, to be able to co-promote those, were highlights of my career. Sergio Martinez Chavez.
So you were promoting Mickey for those?
Yeah. I promoted Mickey after the Leija fight for the rest of his career. And Mickey, by the way, is coming up here. Called me to tell me he's coming up here. I love Mickey Ward. I mean, one of the great people in the history of boxing. And one of the great guys. You can't find a better person. You want to talk about loyalty, friendship. You know, I'm blessed to have friendships with a number of my ex-fighters. Martinez, Sergio, Mickey, Peter Manfredo sends me. Every morning I get a message from Peter Manfredo Jr. that he sends to his family and friends to make sure everybody's okay. Like, it's a wake-up morning. It's a beautiful Tuesday, and I respond every day, you know, and I'm so grateful to have that kind of relationship with Peter. But you know, I've maintained a lot of strong relationships over the years with the majority of my ex-fighters and my fighters, and that makes me grateful.
Hey, so obviously you mentioned Will Gatti there, like, because you must have said about it, you know, dozens of times and hundreds of times in the 20 years since he's come and gone. But just go back to the night of the first fight. I mean, you're there ringside. What are you thinking as you watch it unfold? The first one.
I'm thinking, I was right all these years. It's as good as I thought it would be. that's what I thought. But I'll be honest with you, I was very close to both guys. I mean, Mickey was my fighter, but Arturo was a close personal friend of mine. And his manager, Pat Lynch, to this day, is a close personal friend of mine. And I had a great relationship with Kathy in Main Events back then. And I had a lot to do with Arturo's career and with his rise as a TV star. I signed him to his HBO deal. Not only did I sign him to his HBO deal, I sort of picked him among the Main Events fighters and said to Kathy and Dan Duva at the time, I love this kid. This kid's going to be a star. And it became clear to me that Arturo's, the blood and guts warrior nature of Arturo Gatti transcended wins and losses. The wins and losses didn't matter.
Yeah.
They shouldn't matter in general. They shouldn't. And I mean, boxing overvalues zeros. But Arturo's losses, no one gave a damn. He was still one of our biggest stars. Arturo could roll off a loss and come back and still pull a huge rating and be a big star. So I loved Gatti. He was my boy. I mean, Arthur was my friend. But I also knew that Mickey didn't get paid a lot of money for that first fight, and that Arturo was set for life already. Arturo made a fortune. I mean, what happened to Arturo in his life, and may he rest in peace, what a horrible turn of events. But I was rooting hard for Mickey because Mickey needed that win to create the rest of a trilogy that would allow him to leave okay for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
By winning that fight, Mickey was able to make millions of dollars in his next few fights and walk away, become the fighter, become the subject of that film, and walk away as a cult figure in boxing.
Which, weirdly, the fighter didn't even touch upon that trilogy.
No, and I mean, I always thought there could have been such a tremendous movie, yeah, about that trilogy and his relationship.
Yeah, when he trained
with Gatti, that lasted until Arthur's death.
Yeah,
they were very, very close. I went to Arthur's funeral in Canada with Mickey.
Yeah. So what did you prefer then, the TV exec or the boxing promoter? What's the best gig?
I was really fucking good at the TV exec gig. I was pretty good at the promotional gig too. I think my personality was better suited for the TV exec thing in some ways, but the downside was, as a television executive, you needed to have a boss. And I think I'm a better boss than I am an employee. And in some ways, being able to control my own destiny and my own time and only have to answer to me has allowed me to do things in my life that I've really enjoyed. I love being the managing owner of the Richmond Flying Squirrels. I love being the managing owner of the Montgomery Biscuits. The same kind of familial relationship I have with my employees at DBE. I mean, Meredith Greenberg was Meredith Kessler. She's worked with me since basically she got out of college. Alex Dombroff's on his second tour of duty with me. He worked with me before he went to law school. Now he came in as my lawyer. Even my ex-employees, Ron Rizzo worked for me multiple times. You know, I'm friendly with almost all my ex-employees. And it's a family. It's like a family kind of thing. Well, I have the same kind of family in baseball, which I also love. And baseball, minor league baseball, is much more like family entertainment, like the county fair,
right,
kind of thing, than it is. It's like a very nice yin-yang with boxing, which, as much as I love it and as much as it has a piece of my being, can be really dark. And that darkness doesn't really exist in the day-to-day of my minor league baseball life. So being involved in other things has sort of given me that balance that I didn't have at HBO.
So, pardon me asking.
I don't regret the fact. I told someone to go fuck themselves at HBO, which caused my me to have to make a shift in my career. Do I regret having done that? Not really.
Who did you tell?
Jeff Bukas, who was then the chairman of HBO. But I don't regret it. He deserved it, in my humble opinion. But you know what? I mean, like, you know, you have to be, I'm an adult. You realize when you tell the governor, you know, to go F himself, that it's going to impact and change your career.
Got to be some
repercussions. But it might have been the necessary move for me to change my career trajectory in a way that was more personally fulfilling. Because having the opportunity to work and own those two baseball teams, to work in baseball as well as in boxing, to produce films and publish books, you know, under my company, to do things like that that I never would have done had I been all in on boxing. I regret, this may be egomaniacal of me to say, but there's part of me that believes had I been a better corporate citizen and gotten the gig as president of HBO Sports, I don't think HBO would be out of boxing right now. And it hurt me deeply when HBO left boxing. You know, those glory days with Seth Abraham and Russ Greenberg, Mark Taffet, Dave Harmon, and all these other guys that are now producers and have done great things in the sports industry and in boxing. The days of Lampley and Merchant and Foreman on microphone, and I mean, those were great days, and I miss them.
Iconic.
And they were, and also we never had an exclusive deal with a promoter in all my years at HBO, and I actually think that one of the reasons why HBO spiraled down in boxing was a decision to do exclusivity that happened in the 2000s when they did a deal with Golden Boy. And I'm not pointing fingers at Golden Boy, because anybody out there would have accepted an exclusive deal. I'm not blaming them. But I think exclusivity, the same way it's not working for DAZN, in my view, the same way it doesn't really work for any of... Yeah, you can make good boxing programming with one promoter or with a couple of promoters and on an exclusive basis. But what you wind up doing is you make it much more difficult to have your Super Bowls, to have your Premier League championship games. We don't get those equivalents often enough. Our biggest and best fights often don't happen, and when they do happen, sometimes they happen when they're anticlimactic.
Sure.
They don't happen when they need to happen. Like right now, I'm really crossing my fingers that Spence fights Crawford this year. Because when you get beyond this year, enough waiting. Who's going to give a shit at that point? It hasn't gotten bigger by waiting. But that's a fight that needs to happen. I want to see... Look, I have no rooting interest in AJ versus Usyk. But it's terrible to me that Wilder never fought AJ. Joshua when they were undefeated. It's terrible to me that Fury may not wind up fighting Joshua, because if Usyk beats Joshua, who's going to care, right? And frankly, if Usyk beats Joshua, I don't really expect Tyson to come back for that fight.
It's not the same money as a Joshua fight, is it?
No, nor is it the same interest, and nor is it a particularly great matchup. And, you know, Fury's a smart guy. You know, I probably would favor Fury in the fight, but it's not a, you know, if Joshua were to beat Usyk, Joshua Fury is one of the biggest fights ever.
Yeah.
Joshua were to beat Usyk, Deontay comes back, it's also one of the biggest fights ever. Sure. Whereas Usyk wins, those matchups among the top guys in the division become less compelling.
Hey, when you talk about that golden era, that iconic era that we mentioned, what nights stand out for you?
There were so many.
As a TV exec.
There were so many. So many. The Barrera-Morales fights. The, you know, Bo Holyfield, Lewis, and, you know, Lennox's fights for HBO in that period. All those big events with De La Hoya, De La Hoya Mosley, De La Hoya Chavez.
Vargas.
I mean, there were big fights every month. And then also the Boxing After Dark stuff. You know, all those Gatti fights. And
what about Naz?
Well, what the the Nas fight with Kevin Kelly will forever be one of the greatest nights of my life. Nas dancing in to Madison Square Garden in a 20-minute entrance where no one in that room knew what the fuck was going on. And, you know, HBO promoted that fight like it was a Madonna concert. There were billboards all over Times Square, all over New York City. The Garden had a lot of people in it, even though a lot of people didn't really know Nassim. And he was fighting Kevin Kelly, who was very popular in the New York area. But Kevin was still a featherweight. And that was an area where featherweights weren't really selling out the Garden. And when this little kid from Yemen, this little Brit from Yemen, you know, takes a 20-minute dance to his seats, and the whole of Madison Square Garden is on their feet dancing, and he dances his way into the ring where Kevin Kelly's been waiting for a half hour. Bell rings for the first round, and before you know it, Nassim's on his ass because Kelly drops him. The drama of that fight was extraordinary, and then in completely star fashion, Nassim gets the win, knocks out Kelly, and you know, makes history. And that was one of the most triumphant introductions to a new market that I've ever seen a fighter make. And Nassim was an irreplaceable, one-of-a-kind, historic showman. Historic.
Were you always a believer in Lennox?
Oh, yeah. And I always loved Lennox. You know, and I was a big reggae fan, so Lennox and I had, like, we bonded over music, and Lennox, I mean, I always believed in Lennox. My boss believed in Lennox, and the chairman of HBO at the time, Michael Fuchs, and Seth Abraham, they really believed in Lennox, and they sent me to England to go do a deal with Lennox, go sign Lennox, and we brought Lennox back. Seth really believed in Lennox. In my view, Lennox is one of the top eight heavyweights of all time, and in my mind, one of the greatest UK heavyweight of all time, greatest UK fighter of all time.
And tell me about your relationship with the talent, with likes of Larry and Jim.
I'm going to call Larry later today. I still stay in touch with both guys. I love them. They were huge influences on me. They were mentors to me when I was a little kid starting at HBO. Look, I was lucky. When I think back at the mentors I have, a lot of them aren't around anymore. Manny Stewart, Eddie Futch, Jimmy Glenn, Al Gavin, one of the famous cut men who taught me so much. You know, Ali, Frazier. I mean, all these guys I grew up with and got to spend time with as a young TV executive and a young guy trying to make his bones in boxing and learn as much as I can. I've had a lot of mentors. Jack Newfield, the New York Post editor and writer, was a great mentor of mine. Introduced me to so many amazing people in all walks of life, not just in boxing, but people in politics, in journalism, in prose, and literary people. And you know, I've had the pleasure of having dinner and spending time with so many people that wanted to pick my brain and talk boxing, but gave me the opportunity to pick their brains and talk about so many other areas I wouldn't have been exposed to. The opportunities that boxing has given me in my life, I'd be a real ingrate if I didn't acknowledge that. I'm not proud that I've had this run in boxing. For all of its guilty pleasure, for all of its darkness, it's never a dull moment. Few things are more colorful. Few things are more theatrical. Few things are more invigorating. Yet few things are more heartbreaking. See, it's got that sort of like balance, that scales of balance that are so part of living life. You know, everybody pretty much on this earth loses their mother and father. You know, and too often mothers and fathers lose their children. I mean, there are knocks in our journeys. There are times in our lives where we all get knocked down.
Yeah.
But that metaphor in boxing for getting knocked down and getting up is one of the reasons why we're so relatable to everybody. You know, our sport should be bigger right now than it is because of that relatability.
Sure.
You know? And the frustrating thing is we're responsible to a large extent for our world, our little sport, not being bigger than it is. Like, we bear that responsibility. You know, we can do better. And I hope when I reflect on my career that I've been a voice of at least trying to see our sport be as good as it can be. I know that many people perceive me. You know, Eddie's always said this to my face: "You're such a miserable fuck. Why are you saying all this negative shit all the time?" And he's not the only one that feels that way. But I sort of view boxing like you have that family member, whether it's a brother, a sister, or a child, or a parent, that's troubled and endangered and a mess, but you love them and you want to see them be better. And that's sort of how I sort of view my relationship with boxing. And I think that to the extent I've been critical of my own world, it's because I'm desirous of wanting to see it be what it can be.
Sure. And because we see the glimpses, right? We see the glimpses. We see the potential, whether it's a great fight and the feedback that you get when it dominates the sports pages again after a great fight and there's a real buzz about it. We know the promised land. We know what it looks like. We just can't seem to live there.
Look, it's just, it's, you know, we see moments of greatness with regularity, you know, and you see incredible acts of personal bravery in the ring. You see, you know, people overcoming the biggest of obstacles. You know, we've said this earlier, boxers for the most part don't, you know, they're not walking the yellow brick road. They're you know, most of them have a difficult road to success. And most of them had to overcome poverty or worse. There's a reason we've always been the sport of immigrants and refugees. You know, but in I watched the tape the other day. I mean, I'm losing my train of thought, but not really. That video of the African fighter in the ring, where he looks like everything's normal, he hits his opponent, the opponent falls out of the ring, and then he loses his orientation completely and starts punching the air. It was one of the saddest things I've ever seen. And then, like, that video, literally, while I was in Australia, I saw it and literally made my stomach turn. And then returned a few days later to see, here in the last day or two, that he died. That he indeed had a brain bleed, collapsed later, went to hospital and died. Knowing that there's no worldwide database for injury, knowing that there's no American database for injury, knowing that head tests aren't even required in most states in the United States, that you can miserably fail a head test and have evidence of brain damage, yet that information will not find its way to states that have no regulation, basically, and that a blood test and an eye test can be enough for a brain injured fighter to go and put his life at risk. Some of the ways in which we fail our athletes and we fail ourselves are barbaric and simply unacceptable. But, and I think you know this because you wrote that book. And similar to, I know another writer who's been pigeonholed by his concentration on cheating and steroids and drug use in boxing. People don't want to hear the dark stuff. They don't want to be beat on the head with what's negative about our sport, you know. But if you don't write about it or you don't talk about it and you don't confront it, how does it ever get better?
Exactly.
And if you don't at least make an effort to flash a light on it to make it better,
you're complicit with ignoring it.
Exactly, and whereas I don't have any illusions about my words having made much of a difference all these years, I am at least proud of the consistency of my messaging and how I have tried to use some of the... I've tried to conduct myself within my own universe in a way consistent with what I believe. Sure. So if I see a fighter that I believe is diminished, you know, even if there's another payday in them, I have tended to end a relationship. When I was a TV executive, the same thing was true. You know, we ended relationships with Riddick Bowe and Tommy Hearns and others at points in time where they still were coming off wins and could have been major attractions in particular matchups, but we said no, enough's enough. And I've tried to carry that through as a promoter. I try to pay attention to who's put in the ring as opponents, star fighters. If someone has suffered a number of consistent concussive injuries, my matchmakers and the people that work for me know I am not okay with a fighter that's, you know, suffered concussive injuries 6, 7, 8 times in their career. I pay attention to the BSI index, which is something that you now have on BoxRec, where they make judgments on likelihood of injury based upon the nature of your career.
Yeah.
How many times you've been knocked out, how old are you, how long have you been fighting, how many losses in a row. You know, I nothing's perfect. You know, if you survey the fights I promoted over the years, you're going to find things that I wouldn't be proud of. But I've tried to conduct myself in a way that's consistent with what I believe.
So, you know, you said when you obviously left HBO under the bad graces of the boss, was it in the back of your mind to always set up your own promotional company?
No.
Anyway?
I wanted to get out and not do boxing. I actually thought it was their revenge a little bit that they made me stay in boxing. You know, it was part of the settlement. I really just wanted to get the check, go out and buy a minor league baseball team and get another job, do something different. I'm really being honest. I really sort of was put in a position where I was given money to start my company, but the concentration really had to be in boxing because the money was earmarked for boxing, for signing boxers, and I was given dates to program for HBO. I understand why they did that. I was good at programming dates.
Sure.
And they gave me the opportunity to provide them with events, which I did. And I think I gave them some good programming when I did.
Because when you signed the Olympians, it was kind of like the biggest impact in signing Olympians since main events in 84, right?
Correct. And that's because I was given a big chunk of money. But I learned the hard way. I signed Ricardo Williams, who was one of the greatest amateurs I ever saw, who never made the adjustment to pro. And the kid came from a great family and just got himself in personal trouble and really messed his whole career up.
Are you still in touch with him?
Ricardo, no. No, I wish him nothing but the best. His family were nice people. But he had all the talent in the world and just threw it away. But Jermaine was the other big signing of that Olympic class for me. And, you know, while his career ended abruptly and in a negative way, Jermaine had a great run. And had Jermaine been able to hold things together better, he had Hall of Fame kind of talent.
Who didn't you sign that you wanted to?
Oh, there were plenty over the years, and plenty of guys had the opportunity to sign and made mistakes and didn't. There have been loads of them. You know what, you can't look back and regret that kind of thing.
Is there one that you think, that, you know, when you had an opportunity, it was a contract on the table or something as a promoter, and you were like...
I mean, I had Joe Smith, and the guy who worked for me just failed to sign the contract. You know, I had Kovalev at one point when he was young. I could have, before he went to main events, was offered to my company. Caleb Plant, I could have signed. I mean, there are loads of quality. I mean, when you're in it as long as I was, there are literally tens of them.
I mean, it's not quite the same as Peltz with Hagler, right?
It's not. But I'll say this. Look, I mean, I could go the other way. When everyone passed on Sergio Martinez, I knew what I, you know, Samson brought him to me after he brought him to everyone else, and no one would work with him. And that became one of the greatest signings of my career and one of the greatest athletes and boxers I've ever worked with. And you got to remember, Sergio came over unknown in his 30s, already with a bad leg. And look at what he accomplished.
Well, he wasn't unknown in the UK. He'd caused a stir in the UK, right, with the first part of his career.
Yeah, that's true.
So he'd been beating up our guys over there for a while. But Sergio fought the other day, right?
Still fighting. I mean, we're still friendly. I'm not involved in his comeback. I didn't want to be involved in his comeback. But, look, he's... I don't think he needs the money. I don't know what's motivating him to keep fighting. I think he's just enjoying the spotlight a little bit. I don't know. But he's world-ranked again, which is wild.
Do you have a go-to list of the best events you've promoted?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah.
What's in there? What's amongst?
As a promoter, the Taylor fights with Pavlik, with Hopkins, I co-promoted all those. I love the Sergio Chavez co-promotion with Top Rank was sensational.
The one where Sergio was hanging on.
But he beat the living bejesus out of Chavez for 11 rounds only to get caught. But that final round, when he got up after being completely out and then won the rest of the round, was remarkable. Look, I've had a lot of ups, a lot of joys of promoting events. Look, I promoted a lot of those PBC events with Spence and Davis and the Charlos. I mean, I did a lot of those PBC events in my 4 or 5 years working with Heyman, and a lot of great events there too.
We don't know Heyman. What's he like?
Most people don't know Heyman.
Do you know Heyman?
I do better than most people, I think. I mean, not as well as his intimates, but certainly better than most people in boxing, I think. What's he like? Brilliant guy. Very, very bright. Extremely, extremely smart guy. Excellent businessman. Loves boxing. He is not anti-fighter. His brother was a fighter, Bobby Heyman, who fought Ray Leonard. I think that one of the things that led Al to get into managing, and he won't say promoting, but I'll say promoting, was a desire to see the fighters be treated more fairly. I think he looked at his brother's career and learned lessons from that in terms of how often fighters are not treated fairly. I think he did a tremendous job as a partner with Mayweather and building Mayweather to money Mayweather superstardom. Al's a very smart guy and a complicated guy, a guy that doesn't like to be seen, that likes to fly under the radar. Very few pictures of Al exist.
Talking of flying under the radar, what do you think of Eddie?
There are things that he's very good at. He's an incredibly charismatic kind of guy. He's very good on camera, good-looking guy, rich kid. I Eddie and I are a little bit like oil and water. We're very different. And at the moment, I wouldn't say our relationship's very strong. I sort of think Eddie was born on third base, and he's somewhere between third and home right now. I don't think Eddie's the best winner. I think that a lot of... Eddie has undeniable skills as a promoter. In some ways, he does things... Some of the things that King did in his prime, the only person that does them the way King did back then now is Eddie. Eddie's great with a camera, being a person, like just being an entertainer. He's got a great sense of pizzazz. But I also think that Eddie promotes himself more than he promotes any fighter or fight.
Have you guys been out for dinner?
What?
Have you guys been out for dinner or anything like that?
We've had like business meetings over breakfast and stuff. But I've gotten hammered with King and Aram. Just like hammered and had social nights with them over years. I've done the same with a lot of promoters all over the world. I don't think Eddie has those kind of relationships, to be honest with you. I actually think that, like, one of the things, if I was going to make it, and I've like made this criticism of Eddie, so I'll make it on this podcast, he doesn't have the most collegial relationships with his contemporaries. Like, he doesn't really hang out with other promoters, and there's a lot of, he likes to get sort of, Eddie likes to be the center of attention, even if it's not his event or his fighter. But that being said, to some extent, it works for him. I mean, in the UK, Eddie's a celebrity. Eddie's a bigger celebrity in the UK than I would argue every single one of his UK fighters, maybe other than AJ.
Yeah, sure. You mentioned getting hammered with Aram and King together, the three of you.
We've done that. We did that in Memphis in a fucking monumental way. King and Aram and myself dancing on tables drunk with at a blues bar in Memphis. I mean, I've had some fun times with Aram and King.
That's pay-per-view right there.
You know, I've had some wild, but in the old days, honestly, in the 90s and early 2000s, when I first was a promoter, when I was a TV executive, the promoters on both sides would have a big dinner before the fight and go out, often with the biggest boxing writers joining them, and party and celebrate the fact that we were doing a big event. And now, when you really look at it, PBC shits on Matchroom, Matchroom shits on me, I shit on Matchroom, Aram shits on
everyone.
Eddie shits on Aram. One of the things I enjoyed about this last promotion in Australia is I had a great time hanging out with the guys at Top Rank and Aram. It was completely one team effort. Do you know what I mean? We were promoting a big event. They were our co-promoters. Everybody worked to promote the event the entire week. Everybody had dinner together. Everybody broke bread, had cocktails, hung out. It reminded me of the old days. And if I'm going to make a complaint about boxing 2022, that happens way too infrequent. It's way too infrequent.
You mentioned Jack Newfield a bit ago. He obviously wrote The Life and Crimes of Don King. Is there going to be a Life and Crimes of Lou DiBella book coming out?
You know, I don't think there'll be a Life and Crimes of me. I actually think I've been pretty on the straight and narrow in this fucking industry, possibly to my detriment. I think that if I do my tell-all book, it could be one of the great books ever written in boxing. I think I have an incredible number of stories. I have castigated both Don and Bob for not writing their books.
Yeah.
Neither one of them have. I think part of the reason is neither one of them ever got out. They're still both in at 90. I will get out. I think it's sort of necessary to be out to do a real tell-all book. But I think I have some incredible stories to tell, and I am going to write that book.
What is you know, obviously you've talked about table dance with King.
You know, one of the things also is Newfield. I hung out with Newfield as a boxing promoter. He was a big influence on me. He introduced me to guys like Mario Cuomo, late Mario Cuomo, governor of New York, who became a friend. Other writers. I met loads of friends through Jack Newfield, musicians, writers, artists. Jack used to have these nights where we would get together and watch fights. The commissioner of police would be there, as well as the head of a crime family. There would be superstar actors in the room, musicians, comedians, all boxing fans, getting together, having cocktails, eating like giant hero sandwiches, and watching the fights. And I met so many people that became friends through Newfield. The late George Kimball, one of the great sports writers of our time, a dear friend of mine. I met so many people who became lifelong friends through Kimball.
Did you try and get Teddy Atlas at HBO?
Did I try to get Teddy there?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we worked with Teddy for a while. I love Teddy. Teddy was also a friend of Newfield. So, you know, I remember... actually, it's a funny story. I remember that I was like burning the proverbial lantern on both. I was working around the clock, and I was like living sort of a maniacal existence. And my friends who weren't in boxing, it was after my brother died in the early 90s when I was at HBO, suicide, and that's one of the reasons why I sort of consider myself a mental health advocate. But I, in order not to get myself drinking or drugging myself into oblivion after his death, I threw myself totally into work. And some of my friends who were like among my mentors, Newfield, Teddy Atlas, Ron Borges, there were others, had a little, like, had this little intervention for me, thinking I was possibly abusing cocaine because I was so wired all the time. And I was like, I'll never forget it, because I was like sitting there sort of laughing about it, and they were getting pissed off, but like, I wasn't. Like, I wasn't abusing anything. And if anything, I might have been smoking too much weed just to fall asleep, because I was like wired all the time. But it was more that in order to preserve my mental health, what was left of it. And I think also this might have had a little to do with the rise I had in boxing so quickly in the 90s, is after my brother died, one of the few safe places I had was going to boxing matches, hanging out in boxing gyms, hanging out with boxing people. So I sort of was this TV executive who was 24/7 living in the boxing world. And that's why the transition to promoter, even though it wasn't something I was ever really aspired to, was so easy for me.
Sure.
Because I was so immersed worldwide in boxing.
Sure.
You know, before I told the boss to F himself, I don't think it was probably good for my career that every list in the mid or late 90s that were listing the most powerful people in boxing generally had me at the top of the list, often above my boss. Okay, it's never quite a good idea to be above your boss in that kind of a list, you know? And I think maybe the fact that happened was one of the reasons Seth and I had a lot of tension, you know, right before I left HBO. But I'm happy to say Seth's a friend, and I'm grateful for Seth Abraham. I'm grateful. I wouldn't have the life I've had. I never would have been in the Hall of Fame. I never would have accomplished a great deal of what I've accomplished if Seth didn't hire me and then give me the reins to really, like, it takes a lot of confidence for a boss to give his employees the ability to go out and really run their own thing.
Yep.
And one of the great things about Seth that I don't think any of us at the time so appreciated, myself, Greenberg, Taffet, I don't think any of us really totally appreciated, was he gave us a lot of rope to do what we thought was right for the franchise of HBO Boxing.
So you're talking about delegation.
Yeah. Delegation in a way to where you know you're hiring really smart people, and you're giving them the room to do what they think
to show
needs.
How smart they are.
Well, yeah, and I think he gave me that opportunity, but he also gave Russ Greenberg that opportunity and Mark Taffet that opportunity, and I think that was the reason why that period of like the late 80s through 2000 were really the glory years of HBO Sports.
So from that group of 96, why didn't you sign Chris Bird?
I did a lot of fights with Chris Bird. Chris was a regular on our network. You got to remember, I mean, some of the reasons why you signed people were also, it was interesting too, because we were signing people, but the big fights were still happening. We were able to use our market power at the time, because there wasn't that separation of, like, Showtime emerged. In fact, Jay Larkin is getting into the Hall of Fame this class, in one of these three classes. Jay was my dear friend. Jay and I hung out. We like got along really well. And we were way, way bigger than Showtime and boxing at that point. But we made an effort not to step on each other. Like, it was incredibly rare back then that we ever had a big event against Showtime, because Jay and I talked all the time. And there was no reason. I wasn't looking to step on them for no reason. And they weren't looking to hurt us. The big fights happened back then, even though we had exclusive deals with fighters. See, we never had exclusive deals with promoters.
Sure.
But we had exclusive deals with fighters. Why didn't we have one with Chris? Well, I used Chris for a number of big fights. Chris had some of the best nights of his career on HBO. To be honest, we only signed the fighters that really we needed to be able to sort of steer their careers.
Did you work
if we didn't sign Hamed, he never would have come and been a star in America. If we didn't sign Lennox, his career would have centered around Europe.
Sure.
And by the way, when we had Lennox, we also had Holyfield, Bo, Foreman.
Tommy.
Go through the list, all of them. Tommy Morrison. We had the heavyweight division.
David Tua.
Ike Iwabuchi, all of them.
I was just going to ask about Ike. Tell me about Ike.
I don't know. I still can't get past the time that I've stuck the steak knife in the table in front of me. Ike was as crazy as a lunatic. I mean, Ike was literally a lunatic. And he was a dangerous one. I mean, he was...
Not a fun one.
Not a fun one. No. He was troubled. But he was great. And it was funny. I went to a heavyweight explosion of Cedric Kushner's. I did a lot of work with Cedric back then. People forget how great a promoter Cedric was in his prime and what a great eye... Like, his people had a good eye for talent. At one point, Cedric had one of the best stables in all of boxing. Shane Mosley, Vernon Forrest, Haseem Rahman, David Tua, Ike Iwabuchi. But anyway, Cedric was the preeminent promoter of heavyweight talent in the 90s. And Cedric brought me to a show to look at one of his prospects that he wanted to put on HBO. He didn't mention Iwabuchi to me. But I went to the show, and I watched the show, and he said, I want to talk about, I don't remember who it was. I don't want to say the wrong name, but I'm going to use it.
Someone like a Darrell Wilson.
Someone like Obed Sullivan, yeah, let's okay. say. And I want you to see Obed Sullivan. And whatever. After the fights, he was like, well, let's talk about... And I said, no. Let's talk about Ike Iwabuchi. Because that was the guy on that show that impressed me. And he just had that ferocity and that, like, he really looked like a bull with the... You could almost see the intensity and the ferocity of Iwabuchi and his ring walks. And I knew that he was going to be something special. But then when I got to know him a little bit, I knew how troubled he was. And I'll never forget a lunch at the Palm restaurant in New York. He had just beaten Tua. And I think it was after the Tua fight. I don't remember the timing of the lunch, but he was coming off a big win. And everybody was talking about Iwabuchi as potentially the next great heavyweight. And we're sitting there having lunch, and he had this, like, strange, aggressive, perturbed look on his face. And I was just trying to make chit-chat. So we're talking, and I'm chatting with Cedric. I'm chatting with some of Cedric's employees are there. I'm at the table. And I look at Ike, and I said, so, Ike, where are you living these days? And he looks at me, and his eyes get really wide. And he grabs a steak knife, and he puts it over his head, and he plunges it into the center of the table so that the knife is embedded 2 inches into the table. I couldn't pull it out of the table. And he looks at me, and he goes, why do you want to know where I live? Are you coming to get me?
Jesus.
And I looked at Cedric, and I looked at Ike, and I said, frankly, Ike, I was just chatting. I said, I don't give a fuck where you live.
I'm just being nice.
But please don't ever do that in front of me again, basically.
Jeez. So you know who you'll have a million good stories about? Michael Buffer.
I love Michael Buffer. One of the nicest human beings. One of the greatest guys on earth. One of the things we like, he's like a brother. I'll tell you a story about Michael Buffer. My 88-year-old mom, Michael loved my mom when they met years and years ago. And Michael Buffer and my mom are close. They're friends. And Michael and his wife send pictures to my mom and call my mom regularly, email her. Michael has been a part of my mom's life for over 20 years. Like, no one knows this, but Michael's like, you know, my mom considers Michael like family. And I consider Michael like family. And the greatest of all time, in my view, as a ring announcer, no one's better. And we also share a love of rescue animals. Michael and I are both rescue dogs are a big thing to me too.
Oh.
Mental health care, rescue animals.
Oh, you know I'm the same.
Really?
Yeah, I have 5 rescues. Well, I've just had 3 fosters that have now gone on to their forever homes. But
well,
yeah.
All my dogs have been rescues, and my present rescue Papillon doesn't look like a rescue. She's a purebred beautiful little dog.
Yeah, so I rescue pugs for the PDWRA, which I've never mentioned on the podcast before, but the Pug Dog Welfare Rescue Association. So two of mine are rescues from them, and then Topolina
is a rescue from a puppy mill.
Okay.
And today, actually, I'm rescuing a zebra. Don't ask me how, but one of my friends, I support a dog rescue. It's where I got my last dog through a dog rescue run by a guy in boxing named Kevin Deaver, who Kevin expanded his rescue to have an equine rescue.
Okay.
And in a kill shelter, there's a 3-month-old zebra, and the mother was sent to one of those hunting things where they fenced in.
Okay.
I mean, who would want to kill a zebra?
Jeez.
But the baby zebra would be probably in the same fate if it's not rescued. So I actually wrote a fairly big check today to my friend's rescue. So now the zebra, assuming they're able to rescue, there will be a zebra named Lou the Zebra that will be at an equine rescue. And hopefully we can, he's only a couple months old, hopefully we can get that zebra to some kind of a shelter or someone that has an animal
so you don't
farm,
have an
animal rescue.
In New York with all these. Do you live in New York? Do you live
yes,
in the city?
Yes, I do. I live in a little town called Seacliff, which is on a cliff about 45 minutes from the city.
Okay.
Yeah, but I have a little apartment in the city, but I haven't stayed there very often recently.
But you can't take a zebra there.
No, I don't think you can take a zebra anywhere, but I think the idea would be to get the zebra back to health and give it to either a petting zoo or a rescue sort of a kind of compound where
sure.
they have rescue animals and
Just going back, like your era at HBO, it didn't coincide with Mike at all. Mike Tyson, did it? Because he was
no, I actually, it sort of did. The first contract I ever did for a fight in my HBO life was Tyson Douglas.
Wow.
And the only reason I didn't go to Japan is everyone thought it was going to be a long trip for a short fight.
Yeah.
I watched it in my apartment in the city where when Mike got knocked out, the roar. First of all, Mike was doing the biggest ratings in all of sports back then. And you could hear a roar in New York City in the streets from apartment buildings where people watched the knockout. My window was open and listen, I could hear a roar when the fight stopped. HBO didn't do a lot of Mike's fights when I was there, but I knew Mike and we overlapped, not much, but I'm so happy to see where Mike is right now in his life and his career.
You have any good nights out with Mike?
What?
You have any good nights out with Mike?
I've had some nice experiences with Mike over the years. And Mike's, you look at somebody who really turned their life around and became a better human being. Mike worked hard to be a better person. And the Mike Tyson of 2022 is a much better guy than the Mike Tyson of 1992. And I'm very happy for him. And I'm a big Mike Tyson fan these days.
I will wrap this up, Lou, but there was one thing I wanted to mention. I haven't saved it to the last. It's just hit me. But didn't you offer Floyd the slave contract back in the day?
Yeah, we didn't. But I want to tell you, I have a great relationship with Floyd. And after...
Obviously, I've said slave, but I mean inverted commas.
No, that was... That's what Floyd called it. But we had a conversation. And he still... I tell people about this conversation, and I know Floyd does also. In fact, I was... Right before the Conor McGregor fight, it was one of those press conferences, and Floyd was in the back waiting with his family before he went out for the press conference, and he told his family the story about this meeting. But after Floyd called it a slave contract, we had a meeting in my office, just him and me. And he basically said, you know, man, I probably shouldn't have called it a slave contract. And he, you know, he understood the historical nature of that and how offering a young black man who was in his 20s a contract for a record number for a fighter his age, comparing it to slavery, probably wasn't appropriate. But he came to my office and he said something. I'll never forget it. He said, you know, Lou, I'm not saying I was right to say that. I shouldn't have said that. He said, but I want to tell you something. He goes, I'm never going to lose. I'm sitting you here in my office right now, And we're sitting here, and I'm telling you that I am never going to lose in a boxing ring. And that before I'm done, the world's going to recognize me as one of the greatest to ever lift. And it wasn't said with... it's hard to say you would hear something like that, and it wasn't said with...
hyperbole or like that.
And there was no hyperbole to it.
No.
He was being deadly serious.
He was presenting facts.
He was looking me in the eye, and he was saying, I am better than virtually everyone you have ever worked with. And before I am through, you are going to know that I was the best of my time. And I'm never going to lose. And you and everybody else is going to remember me as one of the all-time greats. And he was a kid. And he was right. And I never forgot that day. And it's one of the reasons why, through Floyd's ups and downs and whatever, we've always had a relationship. And that kid who walked in my office that day was one of the most self-aware athletes I've ever seen. He knew how special he was. And his point was, yeah, I went off the rails maybe with calling it a slave contract, but understand where I was coming from, because I know how good I am.
He backed himself to the hilt, didn't he? That's what he did.
He really did. And anyone who doesn't give him his flowers for what he accomplished in the ring is simply being unfair, because he was so brilliant, he never did lose. And by the way, even that fight that people think he lost, the Castillo fight, I was there, he didn't lose. He won that fight. It was close, but he won that fight. And he gave Canelo, young Canelo, a boxing lesson. He was the best of his time.
So this has worked out well for you, and the delay, obviously not the pandemic, but in terms of the induction weekend, because you've got Roy, you've got Floyd.
Bernard was part of my career. Floyd was part of my life and my career in boxing. Andre Ward, another great, all-time great. Leila Lee's getting in. I knew her dad.
Roy Jones.
Roy Jones and I had one of those kind of relationships. I mean, Roy, when we bump into each other, there's going to be a big hug. But Roy and I butted heads a lot during my time at HBO. And I want to throw up a name, because this is the reason I think Roy and I are so cool at this moment of time, because this guy was a dear friend, like a brother to both of us, Artie Curry was the director of talent relations at HBO, the fighter's best friend among the HBO staff. And Artie died way too young, had a knee operation and got an infection and died in his sleep very, very young. He was like this with me. He was truly like a brother to Roy Jones and was like a brother to me. And one of the, you talk about reflection when you get into a Hall of Fame. One of the people I reflect on, all he did for me and his influence in my life, was Artie Curry, who I've thought about a lot this week.
You have kids. Because I was going to say, did you want them to come into boxing?
I'll say this. Would you want your child to be a fighter? No. No. And
would you want them to be in the business?
Would I want my kid to be in the business of boxing? No. And I'll say even this, and my fighters know this, my fighters will tell you this, that I feel this way. I don't want my fighters' children to be in boxing. If they don't, particularly the ones that don't have to, or the ones that just don't look. Now, some of them have gravitated toward it, and if someone, I'm a firm believer that people have to do what's in their heart. You got to follow your dream. But the majority of the prize fighters I know, like Jermaine said to me in a phone call we just had, I'm happy that my son plays golf. He doesn't box.
Yeah.
Boxing takes a toll on people. It takes a very serious toll on those who are the warriors who get in the ring and fight, the men and women who get in the ring and fight. If they have extended careers, the likelihood is the sport is going to damage them to some extent. But if you don't think that the sport takes a toll on managers, promoters, even broadcasters and writers, you see glorious, beautiful things. And you see sad and desperate and vulgar things.
Yeah.
And as elevating and glorious as boxing can be, it can be that heartbreaking and troubling. So I don't regret the trip. It's been a beautiful, wonderful one. But, man, I've been beaten up too. You know, I've had my ups and downs in the business of boxing, from having to confront horrible disloyalty and lies, to having to watch people I loved and fighters I admired and loved be permanently damaged or suffer the ultimate, you know, loss of their lives in a boxing ring. I've seen things that have hurt my soul, not just, you know, that I carry with me all the time. But I don't regret my time in this sport. You know, I got to know people like Muhammad Ali. I got to meet a lot of my heroes and realize I wasn't wrong about picking them. You know, I will always be grateful to Muhammad Ali and his entire family for having had the opportunity to meet him and spend some time with him, but also to get to know what made him tick. What made him tick as a man with Parkinson's, a man whose body was betraying him, who spent the last years of his life trying to be as good a person and give as much back to the world as he could because he wanted his God to be pleased with him when he left this world. And, you know, I had that transistor radio under my pillow. I was mesmerized by him, this good young black man who could talk circles around everyone, including Howard Cosell, who had this looked like a movie star and had this personality that could light up a room, an arena,
a country, a world.
I mean, Ali was the most recognized face on the planet. You know, and then to see him, to watch his body betray him, but watch him continue to give service to people. And I mean, he was as accessible a superstar as existed. You know, I one of my lasting memories was walking to go to a Broadway theater on... I left the HBO building when I was at HBO, and I was heading to a Broadway theater, 7 o'clock or 7:30 start of a play. And I'm heading over to the theater, and there's a giant mob in front of one of the Broadway theaters. And I'm passing that theater, and as they get closer, I see it's Ali with, like, his driver, at the time, bodyguard, whatever you want to call him, standing in front of a theater, signing pamphlets about Islam. Introduction to Islam, and signing a pamphlet to every person that wanted one. And it was 7 o'clock. I went to the theater. I left the theater about 9:45, and I see the mob is still in front of the theater, and I'm like, it can't be. And I went to the theater,
and it still was.
And it was. It was Muhammad, and he's standing there, and he's continuing to sign these pamphlets. And I said, Muhammad, what? You've been here 3 hours. Like, what makes you, like, you've been signing these things for 3 hours. Why are you still here? He said, I want to go to heaven. I want God to be pleased with me. And, Gustavo, good to see you, brother. And I blew my mind. It really was one of my lasting memories about Muhammad. And by the way, over the years, I bought a bunch of those pamphlets. Like, there were a couple I had because, frankly, he gave them to me in the course of the years I knew him. But I bought a lot of other, like, those pamphlets. I remember that day. And I've given those as gifts.
Oh, nice.
To a number of, like, friends and family members. Because they were lasting memories to me of my hero.
Well... Lou, let's put a bow on it. I really appreciate your time. I can't promise you that you're going to go to heavens for spending so much time with me on a couple of days before you're due to promote here at the Turning Stone, but I'm hugely grateful we had the opportunity to sit down. Thank you. Thank you so much.
You know, and look, the glorious thing about boxing is in our greatest moments, there's no sport that is better than we are. In our greatest events, there's no sport capable of captivating the whole world the way we are. And from a society, when you look at history, very few sports have the number of great fighters that we have that created societal change. From Jack Johnson to Jack Dempsey, all over the world, to fighters that made history all over the world. We are ingrained in the fabric of sport.
Yeah.
Everywhere on this planet. Boxing can be as sick as it can be, but boxing is eternal. You know, people were fighting for other people's entertainment in the days of the cavemen, and people will fight for other people's entertainment long after you and I are gone. And that's one of the reasons why I'll continue to try to make our sport better for as long as I have any voice in it, even beyond my years as a promoter, because we aren't going anywhere. We're going to be here forever. We owe it to our sport to be better than we now are.
Brilliant, Lou. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you.
Thank you, bro.
So huge thanks to Lou DiBella. That was a great chat. I really enjoyed it. It went so briskly. I didn't actually need to do much, as I'm sure many of you will notice. But one thing I will say is it's clear Lou had been in a reflective mood. And obviously, you know, I mentioned at the top there that we had been talking about damage for the last few months on and off. And I think that's maybe helped him, not helped him, but maybe it's seen him reflect even more. Although, as I said, the subject matter was something he'd been given some thought to for some time anyway. But I think it could, you know, maybe being inducted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame, it's made Lou a little bit more reflective. He certainly reiterated some of this podcast in his Hall of Fame speech that came a few days later. And I mean, one thing that will always stand out to me is when we were talking there about advice our fathers gave us and that line about people who have everything, but if you're a piece of shit, you're still a piece of shit. That really hit home. It's so true. In a world where people sort of boast about what they've got, what they have, and that kind of stuff, like, you can't buy class. And I found Lou a classy guy. And I, you know, like I said, he genuinely puts his fighters first. And I think that's evident when you look through his track record. Also, talking about people who put fighters first or put their people first, huge thanks to my sponsors, Hanson Lee Resourcing. They've been with me now for about 160 episodes. So huge thanks to Blaz and the gang. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, they'll help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Derek Andrews at Delco Safety Compliance, and they're a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide, and they provide expert impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance, and you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. You can hear I'm a little bit jet-lagged, a little bit run down from being in America. It's been a fantastic trip at the International Boxing Hall of Fame, as always. And as I mentioned earlier, if you can spread the word about this podcast, if you're enjoying it, if you can tweet a link out, share it with your friends, if you can write a review up on iTunes or whatever platform you choose to listen to Boxing Life Stories, it's hugely appreciated. And also, if you'd like to sponsor this podcast and me moving forwards, you can go to patreon.com/TristDixon, where you can get early episodes advanced with Baby Joe Messi, referee Tony Weeks, and trainer Aaron Snowell. That's all up on there now, as well as the latest on my book with Matthew Saad Mohammed. Thanks so much to Lou DiBella. What a couple of weeks. Back-to-back Hall of Famers with Kathy Duver and now Lou. That's great stuff. If you agree, please spread the word, share the links, write a review for me where you listen to Boxing Life Stories, and I will be back next week.